Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the House Committee on Human Services. We have two agenda items, and I'd like to open up the first one. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4084. And colleagues, instead of doing the usual introduction, it will be well served by my co-chair on the work group, Representative Hoyle, and Belissa from Legislative Council, our author. If they'd come forward, we will get started on an overview. So please join us. And I would say, as they're coming up, colleagues, that their comments are going to be in the context of the dash ones, if that's helpful. And with that, identify yourself and help us understand the bill a little better.
I am Belissa Seidlick, Deputy Legislative Counsel and the drafter of House Bill 4084, and I've been asked to provide a section-by-section description of the bill. And I will just begin with doing so.
Do you have a document?
Pardon me?
You're going with the original bill.
I am reading from House Bill 4084 as printed, as well as the dash one amendments, which Co-Chair Gilliam referred to.
Colleagues, I was supposed to pass this out, and as you know, if it's an administrative issue, it's a problem. So I'm going to get Representative Greenlee, you're going to have this in just a second.
Thank you.
If you flip through that, Representative Greenlee, you will find the section by section chart.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Sorry about that.
We have another one. We need one more down here.
Is this on the website?
No, I don't find it.
Received this just right now. The amendment.
Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. Section 1 starts with creating, adding to the crime of assault in the third degree, the behavior of intentionally or knowingly causing physical injury to an elderly person. And that did not exist before. So this amends ORS 163, 165 in that regard, and makes that kind of action, the intentional or knowing causing a physical injury to an elderly person, defined as someone 65 years of age or older, as a Class C felony. Section 2 on page 2, actually the change to ORS 131, 125 appears on page 3 of the bill. And this extends the statute of limitations for prosecution of the listed crimes from 3 to 6 years. And these are all felonies. And this statute of limitations extension happens when the victim is 65 years of age or older. Section 3 on page 4 is simply a conforming amendment because of a renumbering change. Section 4 on page 4, the change to ORS 137, 225 is actually on page 6, and this provides that a defendant cannot move to set aside a conviction for criminal mistreatment in the first or second degree if the victim is 65 years of age or older. So this is in addition to that statute. On page 8, this is where the dash 1 amendments begin. Sections 5 and 6 pertain to the elder abuse reporting laws, and they add a section to that series that requires health care providers to permit law enforcement and Department of Human Services to inspect, copy, or obtain protected health information of elderly persons that are the subject of an investigation for abuse under those statutes. And this did not exist before. So this is new law, or it would be if this bill passes. The amendment to this appears at line 6. And in addition to inspecting and copying protected health information, it would permit law enforcement or DHS to, quote, otherwise obtain this protected health information. Section 7 and 8, also on page 8, are would-be new law that's added to the series pertaining to long-term care facilities, in particular abuse investigations in that context. And similar to sections 5 and 6, these sections would require health care providers to permit inspection, copying, or otherwise obtaining protected health information of a resident who is the subject of an abuse investigation in a long-term care facility. Sections 9 and 10 are also on page 8. This would add new law to the series of statutes pertaining to financial records, which there's been a little confusion because that whole set of statutes was renumbered after the 2011 session. So that might just be a note that persons may want to make if they're unfamiliar with some of the references. This would add a section that would require financial institutions to disclose and provide copies of financial records of a person, either an elderly person or a resident in a long-term care facility where there is a pending investigation for abuse. It would also require the requesting law enforcement agency or Department of Health and Human Services to certify certain things that are listed at lines 41 through 45 on page 8, namely that the person is an alleged victim in an abuse investigation, the requester has a reasonable belief that abuse has occurred or is occurring, and the copies are necessary for a determination in the investigation. Continuing on to page 9, this new law would allow, if passed, the financial institution to notify the person whose records are requested that the records have been requested unless the financial institution has been directed not to do so by the law enforcement agency or Department of Human Services. Also on page 9 in section 10, it authorizes the financial institution to request reimbursement for the costs of providing these financial records. There is an amendment on page 9. In the dash ones, this amendment is at lines 4 through 6. And it would add a new new paragraph to subsection 7 that clarifies that if the alleged victim holds an account with the financial institution together with another person who is not an alleged victim, these records can still be requested. Section 11 is on page 9 is simply a conforming amendment. Section 12 modifies the existing statute in the elder abuse reporting laws regarding confidentiality to clarify that in an elder abuse investigation, DHS may provide information about names, witnesses, and records that are compiled during the investigation to a long list of entities that begins at line 36 on page 9 and continues on to page 10. Section 13 on page 10 is basically the same as section 12, but it pertains to confidentiality in abuse investigations being conducted under the statutes pertaining to long-term care facilities. Section 14, also on page 10, creates the resident safety review council. This section, I'll note, is repealed later on June 30th, 2013. And briefly, this council will, or is charged with the responsibility for reviewing information and reports that are provided by the Department of Human Services under Section 15 of the bill, which is on page 11. They're charged with the responsibility to review this information, and the information are reports, basically, about abuse investigations. And then they are to perform what's called a root cause analysis to determine whether these incidences of alleged abuse should be classified as acts of abuse or adverse events. On page 11, here is the repeal section at section 16, providing that the council goes away on June 30th, 2013. Section 17 is amended on page 12 of the bill. It basically provides that under subsection 3A, it adds to the list of crimes where people convicted of those crimes cannot be employed in a caring capacity using public funds. In subsection B, there is an exception to this for certain crimes. They include public indecency, private indecency, invasion of personal privacy, theft one, theft of services, and computer crime, where if 5 years have passed since the date of conviction, then this person may be employed in a caring capacity using public funds. They are still subject to a fitness determination, however, and criminal records check. Section 18 on page 13 clarifies, and the gist of this language appears on page 15 of the bill, clarifies that a person prohibited from employment using public funds under the statute I just discussed being amended is not entitled to a determination of fitness or an appeal of that determination. Apparently, this clarifies a situation where repeated requests were made and clarity was needed, that those rights did not exist. On page 16, a similar requirement or similar clarification is set forth, and the difference between 18 and 19 largely is the type of persons who can perform the criminal background check and requesting of fingerprints. But it's basically the same. It clarifies that a person who is prohibited from employment using public funds for certain types of care services is not entitled to a determination of fitness or an appeal of that determination. And on page 18 of the bill, the dash one amendments actually delete section 20 of the bill and change section 21 so as to require the Department of Human Services no later than October 1st of this year to make a report to interim committees of this legislature regarding the implementation of a statewide call system and 211 system integration as a means of making the required report of elder abuse under ORS 124060. Page 19 has been amended by the dash ones as well in section 22 and 23. Which require the Department of Human Services to, using new or existing materials, develop and implement a training and continuing education curriculum for persons who are required by law to investigate abuse allegations and for persons that provide care to vulnerable persons 65 years of age or older. Then section 23 on page 19 actually has been renumbered by the dash ones, provides that the Department of Human Services shall make a report about these trainings and continuing education curriculum no later than October 1st of this year to the Legislative Assembly. The dash one amendments delete section 24 on page 19. And in section 25, the Legislative Assembly would, if this bill is passed, recreate the Oregon Elder Abuse Work Group, which would, if re-implemented, be again sunsetted on June 30th of 2013. And it would have the same tasks and responsibilities that it did in the prior interim. And that is basically the substance of the bill.
Thank you for taking us through that. I think my colleagues can see what a thorough job you've done and the work group that was preceded by the Adult Protective Services team. Representative Hoyle, would you like to say a few words about the bill now, or you want to be available for questions? I'm open to either.
Val Hoyle, Representative House District 14, West Virginia, Junction City. And this was a bill that had a lot of people come together to collaborate, to figure out what could we do to make a real difference in protecting elders. We want to make sure that we do what's possible in this short February session. We'd like to continue this work because it's critical and important. So I just appreciate how many people did weigh in and come to the table, and I'm very proud of the work that's here. I'd love to stay and answer questions if there are any, although there's much more qualified people. I'm not saying that you're not qualified, my good co-chair. I'm just saying that there's other, you know, certified smart people that may be able to answer questions better.
Thank you. Yes,
thank you,
co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoyle, you and I talked just briefly about Section 6, and there's been some question about Section 6, 8, and 10 about the need for a warrant, and I understand that LC can explain to us that that's not necessary. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, I think one of the things is that the lobbyists for the criminal defense attorneys came to us today to express concerns about this part of the bill. So what I would like to do is, have the bill drafter explain the intent. I've also spoken to the lobbyists and said that we will work to see what we can do to come to some agreement on where their comfort level lies. We also will be having a hearing in the Judiciary Committee on Thursday for a parallel bill that's the same, effectively the a different bill number, same bill, but we absolutely wanted to be sure that we had a judicial review of people that had a judicial background, and I think that might be the best place to address those concerns, but I will defer to you. And then possibly also have Co-Chair Gilliam, I don't know if it would be appropriate to have Detective Smith and possibly, or and Co-Chair Tomei, and possibly the interested parties discuss what their concerns are and why that this was put in here and what the common practice is.
Great.
Are you suggesting an offline discussion or a phone call, or are you suggesting today?
I'm suggesting that people present their concerns today and that we work really hard, offline, online, any way we can to address everyone's concerns to pass the buck.
Thank you. And which is an excellent suggestion, and to remind you, you remember Detective Smith was here, just to tell you who it was. Okay. I just didn't want you to think we were shadowing you or something. Other questions at this point, or we'll move on? Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I guess I take some special privilege being the oldest person on this committee, or at least the oldest person who will admit to being as old as I am. This sort of defines anybody over 65 as vulnerable, huh? Is that the notion? Once you're 65 and one day, you become a vulnerable person?
Happened to me.
Happened to you long before that.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's a serious question.
Yeah, no. Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, it's an excellent question. And I do not think that once you're 65, you're automatically vulnerable. But there is the reason that this work group was put together and this task force was put together and the directive by the governor was put together was that elders are a group of people that are taken advantage of more often than younger people who have different resources, different abilities, and so the scope of the work group from the original bill was to specifically deal with elders. I don't think being elderly automatically makes you vulnerable.
Wait a minute. Being 65 doesn't automatically make you elderly unless we define it by law. That's the point
right,
that I'm
making. Right, but elders in definition are 65 and over. I mean, that's the...
Pretty much. Yes, Representative Greenlee, that's true. In a number of places in the statutes, a vulnerable person is defined as a person 65 years of age or older.
Can I follow up with that?
I wish you would.
Well, I mean, I understand vulnerable. I really do. But the demographics of this country are such there's a very large number of people who are becoming 65 over the next 20 years. And they come with a very different group of assets, very different group of physical status, a very different nutrition status than the people who became 65 in 1940 or 1950 or 1960. And there may be a high correlation, but there, as you know, some very vulnerable people who are not 65. So you have to define vulnerability in a way that's different than chronology. But under this law, if a 64-year-old gets in a fight with a 66-year-old and causes bodily harm, the 64-year-old can now be charged with a Class C felony, I believe, simply because the person was 2 years older. I mean, am I right about that? And does that make sense?
Representative Greenlee, co-chairs, members of the committee, I think I see your point. I think for purposes of applying the law and implementing it, there need to be statutory definitions. And I'll also add that one of the reasons that this bill is relating to vulnerable persons is that it contains changes to statutes that would affect persons who are not elderly, but are vulnerable in the sense that they're in long-term care facilities for any reason, for some one reason or another, and they may be 65 years of age or older, but they may not be.
Before you do, I'll try and be brief.
I want you to follow up, but I just want to say that it's a very good point, and I take the point. But I just say you got to start someplace, and there has to be some definitions. And I also would say, we have a very poor, in my experience going through this work group, we have a very poor official definition of elder abuse. And your point should be carefully examined.
I'd say start by defining vulnerability. I mean, I think that's an important issue.
And I hang my hat on the vulnerable, meaning possibly in need of, but I don't necessarily say 65 is the parachute that makes it work. But we had to start someplace, and that's where we started.
Well, as I read this bill, give up my constitutional rights to having people access my financial and medical records without court. I mean, we're expanding the role of government in a huge way in this case. So we passed this bill, I have now given up my constitutional rights to privacy. Simply, not because I'm vulnerable, although maybe I am, but simply because I'm 77. I mean, it somehow seems very dangerous to me. That you don't have any feeling about that? Is that?
Let me go to Representative Thompson, which I think is on point. Here's a follow-up to you.
I read this a little differently. Maybe I'm missing the point, but doesn't there have to be presumption that something has happened? I mean, I'm not giving up my rights to my bank account because somebody wants to look at them. I'm giving up my rights to my bank account because somebody considers something has happened in my life that I need to be protected from.
Where does it say that?
Well, I don't think this opens up to just go down the street, pick out somebody who looks old, and go get their bank account.
It opens up for a police officer or DHS to go into the bank and say, we're doing an investigation on James C. Thompson, and therefore you need to give me access to his financial records.
But I think something
you
has to happen.
You trust your local police, and you're okay with that, which I mostly do, but not in relation to me.
Yeah.
I don't want to give up my constitutional right simply because I crossed an age. It doesn't. It seems so scary.
I err a little bit the other way. I understand what you're saying, but something has to have happened for people to have a suspicion that this person is vulnerable or has been assaulted. Something. The case is what's the case? Yeah. If you're just walking down the street, there's no case.
Usually they pull up by going into court and saying, here's our case.
We're gonna move on to Representative White.
Sorry, sir.
It's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me pose the question and stop the argument over here.
We aren't arguing.
Or the Love Festival, whichever it was. Let's just say I noticed that Representative Gilliam I called DHS and say Representative Gilliam's been abusing Representative Greenlick by making him buy him drinks and dinner all the time.
I've already reported that.
And I call and make that complaint or think that Representative Gilliam's been messing with Representative Greenlick's funds. Does that mean Department of Human Services then opens up Mr. Greenlick's account and goes and sees if there's been a misallocation without justifying it any further to make that inquiry?
Representative Widener, co-chairs, members of the committee. I think I was not a member of the work group, so I was not a part of the policy discussions.
I want to know what the statute says, because the work group has nothing to do with what we put into law, because that's up to...
Representative Widener, there are provisions in the statutes as well as administrative rules that talk about the requirements for making a report of abuse and when and how to investigate them. And I think there are probably members of the audience who can provide more information about what is needed before you take that step of requesting financial records or protected health information.
And if I may follow up.
Hold on just a moment. You all are grappling with some of the issues that the work group did, and I appreciate it very much. We got to move on. And unless there's another question on another section of the bill for Representative Hoyle or Belisa, I'm going to move on to our other testifiers. Representative Hoyle.
Co-Chair Tomei, Gilliam, what I would hope is that when the other people come up who have the expertise on exactly when and how this process can be used, that they would address these questions, because they're incredibly valid concerns, and we want to make sure that we don't rush something through and not get it right.
And, Belisa, can we infringe on your time and ask you to stay with us in the hearing?
Yes, you certainly may.
You'll stand by. And Representative Hoyle, I'd appreciate it if you'd come up and join us at the dais, and I will ask some of the testifiers to come forward. I want to especially get our Director of the Department of Human Services to come. So if Aaron Kelly Seal will come forward, along with Patty O'Sullivan and Fred Steele. Thank you very much, Madam Director.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Kelly Seal. I'm the Director of the Department of Human Services. DHS is here today to offer testimony in support of House Bill 4084 as amended by the Dash 1 amendments. We believe this bill goes a long way to helping us strengthen protection for seniors and for folks who are vulnerable. And I did ask Fred Steele to come up with me to address some of the questions that have been coming up. I'm going to hit a few high points about some activity the department's involved in. There are several efforts in the bill that the department is tasked with, and I thought it might be important just to give you assurance that we have that work already underway. If you recall, this committee's heard a conversation about this issue on several occasions, and we really appreciate your attention to it. It all started with some pretty negative press last year about sexual exploitation of vulnerable adults in facility-based care, and out of that grew a series of conversations with lots of very smart people talking about what does Oregon need to do to strengthen and enhance protections for seniors and for people with disabilities. So from that, there was a work group report that a work group that the department convened that several of you, including Representative Gilliam, spent quite a bit of time with us on, and then your statute passed and the work group's work continued, and obviously there's more work to be done. The department started on some of the work that the initial group came up with and recommended, and it's represented here as an important accountability function for us to come keep talking to you about it. We've begun a business analysis already about a statewide number for reporting abuse. In fact, we're not doing that only around the issue of elder abuse, but we have multiple phone numbers for child abuse as well, and so we've got our adult abuse and child abuse groups working together on what it could look like to have a single abuse reporting number. We've been talking with 211. We've already met with them. We've been getting some cost estimates around that effort as well, so we'll be ready to come report to you. We are already in the process of developing a competency-based training program, making sure that foundational basic skills for investigating abuse cases are in place and that people are being held to some consistent standards and being equipped to provide the kind of investigatory we take seriously the need to equip people to be able to investigate properly, and the discussion earlier highlights the reason why that is so important. We're also in the process of working in partnership with many stakeholders here to develop and implement additional training focusing on prevention and early detection of abuse. Our hope always is to be able to not have someone have an abuse experience. And I'm also pleased to announce, though, that this isn't part of House Bill 4084. It was a major part of the conversation that came before this committee last time, but on Monday you'll all be getting an email from me, and we are publishing the first ever data book on adult protective services in Oregon. And we're letting you know the numbers representing our 2010 data that focus on how many abuse reports we investigated, what types of abuse, how often they were occurring. So just by way of example, we received over 27,000 reports of abuse against seniors and vulnerable adults with disabilities in 2010. We investigated about 12,000 of those, and of those, over 2,000 reports were substantiated. So in the report, we highlight the number of victims, and of course, all of us believe that one victim is one too many. The report is the first of its kind. It will be followed quickly on the heels of the 2011 data report. This has taken us quite a while to pull together because our data and information systems around this area are needing much improvement. But I look forward to being able to have open dialogue, and it's an important benchmark about the improvement efforts that are represented in this bill. It gives us a chance to really understand whether the kinds of things we're doing are actually having the intended result, which is that fewer people are experiencing abuse and that our abuse response system is effective and efficient. So I want to thank the committee for the time you you've spent on this really important issue. I want to thank the co-chairs of the work group, Representative Gilliam, Representative Hoyle, for your leadership on this, and all the stakeholders for the commitment of time they've made to this. We're very appreciative of the conversation and its elevation, and we look forward to more of them.
Thank you, and I want to be respectful of your time. You are welcome here as long as you can stay. I'd like to pause for a minute in case anyone has a specific question for the director, who I very much appreciate being here once again with us. Anyone? Representative Thompson.
Back to Representative Greenlech's question. Is there, to your knowledge, any definition of vulnerability that has any kind of legal status? It's an awfully subjective term. I don't know how. I don't disagree with him that vulnerability is an issue probably greater than his age, but I'm not sure I've ever seen anything that legally defines vulnerability.
Co-chairs, Representative Thompson, this is why I'm glad that Fred Steele is sitting to my right. He is expert in the laws surrounding the investigations of abuse against vulnerable people, and I think he's the best person to answer your question, if that's okay.
I'm going to say, if you have a question, accept that one, because Fred is the guy. Fred
always asks the wrong question.
I'm fine being here. Should we just
okay.
go ahead with it?
Let's go ahead with Fred.
Mind.
And Fred, obviously, we're very interested in this particular question, mm-hmm. as well as you have a lot to offer. But as well as your expertise in the Never Never area, but please, if you can help us with this question, I'd appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Don't forget to identify.
Yes, thank you, Chairs Gilliam, Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Fred Steele. I manage our Community Adult Protective Services Unit within the Department of Human Services, and I was a member of the Elder Abuse Work Group. And to start with that particular question around vulnerability, or more specifically the way elderly person and that definition plays out in statute and the way we use it for adult protective services in particular, the definition is a default, 65 and older, but to actually protect somebody that is being abused, both in statute and in practice, and statute not only in our abuse statutes, but also in the statutes to the Department of Human Services to protect seniors and then also people with disabilities, but in particular seniors from harm and neglect. There's a lot of deference to independence. I mean, it is a mandate to the department to maintain independence as well as safety and health of Oregonians. So in practice, with those directives to the agency, we very much will go into a situation. We have an allegation of abuse, somebody 65 or older. We assess their capacity, assess the situation. If they have capacity and they don't want us involved, oftentimes we'll back off. Now, if it's a physical abuse situation, maybe a domestic violence situation, you know, we won't back off entirely. We'll still assess the situation in its entirety in the context. But that vulnerability piece is important to us. It's one of the reasons that I would shy away from trying to define what vulnerability is we do see it in other states that define a vulnerable adult that has that there are abuse statutes applied to. And it creates limitations, it creates elements that need to be met before you can even open an abuse investigation and provide protective services to a person. So hopefully that answers that question.
Fred, would you like to continue with your comments, both on the Never Never that I mentioned, but others that you might have about the bill?
Yeah, I think two additional pieces that I'd in particular like to address, and with Patty O'Sullivan here, too. She might have some additional comments to offer on the medical records pieces. There were some questions around Section 6 and Section 8 in the bill. And those particular sections allow the department to obtain medical records from healthcare providers or hospitals. The intent there is to comply with HIPAA, primarily. HIPAA at the federal level, you know, all protected health information is protected and confidential unless there's certain exceptions met. One of the exceptions is in child abuse and adult abuse investigations, it's deference to state law. In statute currently in Oregon, child abuse statutes do have actually this almost this exact same language that you see in Section 6 and in Section 8 to allow access to medical records during an abuse investigation. And so from our perspective, from the department's perspective, these two sections are just closing that loop for our adult abuse investigations as it already pertains to the child abuse investigations. For the financial records piece in Section 10, it's also, again, from our perspective, just closing a loop. Current statute allows, I believe the way it's written is that if a financial institution identifies potential financial exploitation, they actually can, by current statute, share those records with Adult Protective Services. And then by our statutes, we can share those records with law enforcement to complete an investigation. The loop that is currently not there is that if Adult Protective Services comes to a financial institution, whether a bank or a credit union, and says, we have valid reason to believe that there is exploitation occurring, and the only way we can really identify it and prove it is with these financial records and very specific financial records that we would be asking for, we can't. We have a lot of difficulty in obtaining those records. And so it's, you know, and really we just don't get them because of the interpretation of current statute. And this section in Section 10 was ideally trying to address that. Now, as part of the work group and the work that we did, it turned into a relatively lengthy section. But that's because we were actually trying to write in some consumer protection pieces. You know, subsection 2 in the section addresses some of the requirements that we would have to make a demonstration to the financial institution to say, we, you know, these records and these particular records will allow us to protect an individual from exploitation. And one of the things you'll see in the annual report that Aaron mentioned when that comes out on Monday is that there were over 600 substantiated cases of financial exploitation. And this report is for our 2010 numbers. Our 2011 numbers we're still compiling, but it was right around 728. And so we have financial exploitation was 41% of our total abuse substantiations in 2010. I mean, it's a huge problem, and it's growing fast. And there's a lot of other statistics I could provide you on that, but I mean, it is a big problem, and it is a big problem for our seniors in Oregon, so.
Thank you, Fred. In the interest of time, I'm gonna go ahead with Patty, and then we'll have questions. Patty, identify for the record and just briefly say your favorite city you've ever lived in, Oregon.
For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and my very favorite town in Oregon would be Silverton, which I was lucky enough to live in and raise my children in, and it's really a wonderful place to live. With that, with Representative Gilliam's permission, I'll speak to the bill.
Please.
Thank you. I was not on the work group. I was not on the work group, but I am here to testify in support of this bill, and in particular, Sections 6 and 8. During the work group, or very quickly after, Fred contacted me from our past relationship in the department and said, we have an issue, and I didn't know about it. I haven't been at the Hospital Association that long, so I gathered together some of our folks on our compliance committee, and we met with Fred, and I found out very quickly that this has been a long-standing problem, that our hospitals don't feel like, without specific statutory right to share the records with the police and with investigators, that it would be a violation of HIPAA. Or they've said, go back and get a warrant. Or they've had to try to have the family members talk the senior person into allowing it. And that's not always very comfortable, because it could very well be the family members who are the abusers. It's a very uncomfortable situation for everybody. But unless you see what the actual medical records say about the injuries, it's very difficult for an investigator or a police officer to understand what the injuries are and whether they were because of abuse or a fall, which is typical, she fell down. This is the same thing with kids, and we do, Aaron and Fred have mentioned, we already do have statutory authority in the kids' laws, and what we are very pleased that they have added that to this bill. We fully support it, and again, it's been a long-standing problem. The amendments to those sections also allow for an for not only a paper sharing, but an oral sharing, so that the investigator or the police officer can also speak with the doctor or the nurse about, you know, what the injuries mean. And without those specific things, we feel with that our hands are tied because of HIPAA. So we're very pleased to support this this bill, and especially these parts of the bill.
Thank you. Now, colleagues, before I go to questions, I want to make sure you know where we're going here on schedule. I'd entertain questions of this panel till about 4, and then we're going to temporarily close recess on this public hearing, and Representative Tomei will be chairing for a first hearing on House Bill 4077. Then we'll come back again to finish up the testimony on this bill. So if you have questions of this panel, I would entertain Representative Whiter.
Thank you. And Representative. So back to where I was getting earlier. I make the phone call. Representative Gilliam's abusing Representative Greenlick. He's stealing his money. Do you have to go investigate and look into Mr. Greenlick at that point?
Co-chairs, Tomei Gilliam, Representative Widener, if we receive that allegation, by statute, we are mandated to go investigate. When we get to the point of talking to the reported victim in a case, that reported victim says, no, I know what I'm doing, I know I'm giving my money, and I want to be giving my money in this way, then that's the end of the investigation at that point.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? I'll just go ahead.
Please follow up.
Line 33, law enforcement agency, the department or the department's designee, without consent of the person or of the person's caretaker, fiduciary, or legal representative. Could we not put some sort of, I would say, something in place where we had, say, a designee for next of kin and on down the line to contact? So if the allegation is against his son here, who is our good co-chair Gilliam, the son of Representative Greenlick, you would go to
please.
You would go to me, the awful stepson, and I would say, yes, I think he is, you should investigate. Can we have something like that without you going straight into his account, without any sort of consent or contacting somebody? Because the way I read this right now, and I went over to 124-70, that call just needs to be made, and you can go look at his bank records. And right now, I mean, just, I have a grandmother who's 98. I'm over there taking care of her while my parents are gone, because she has to have somebody there all the time. I get a call from somebody from the state asking, well, how much money does she have in her account and things like this. I'm like, what business is it of the state to know my grandma's bank account? So this stuff's already happening, and there's some privacy issues I already have with what we're doing, and now we're going into something where the state or the police can go straight into the bank account.
Fred, do you have a response?
The response may not, it may not specifically answer your question or be a satisfactory answer, but because you know, 90% of the time, most of the time, we from Adult Protective Services are there to work with the reported victim. We would still, in almost any case that we can, obtain their permission to look at their financial records. What this is really trying to address, and maybe we need to go back and work the language a little bit to address that concern that you bring up, Representative Widener, is the issue and the situations where the individual does not have capacity, or they have a guardian or a conservator, or have somebody that has power of attorney over their financial records and their finances.
Or a trust.
And those are the person, or those are the people, or a person, an individual that is actually committing the financial exploitation. When we go and ask for permission now, because that is the one route we could go, is ask for permission to obtain financial records, the answer is generally no, because they don't want us opening that up. 100% of the time the answer is no, because they are the abuser. That's what this was trying to address. We would still, as a department, because we're there to work with the individual and the individual victim, assess their capacity. If they have capacity, it's, again, we default to our requirements, and it's in ORS Chapter 410 for the department to defer to somebody's independence. It's almost a stronger requirement than the safety and health in many instances, and definitely in our Adult Protective Services practice. So I don't know if that specifically answers your question, or at least satisfies your question. But
I think for me to be comfortable with this, we just need to clear up the
language. Representative Greenwood.
I'm just wondering how much trouble you have right now getting to financial records when your investigation leads you in that direction.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Representative Greenlake. The numbers, I'm trying to pull those right now because I was expecting that question from our data system. And that in 2011, we had 700, and this isn't in the Adult Protective Service report, although it probably will be in our next one. As I mean, this took a lot of work to get out our first one. I expect our one with our 2011 numbers to be out within, you know, a few months or, you know, for next 4 or 5 months. We had 728 substantiated financial exploitation cases in 2011. There were around 2,600 investigations. We had probably around 250 cases that were inconclusive. They weren't unsubstantiated and they weren't substantiated, oftentimes because we can't obtain financial records. And so that was about 250 cases. And in those cases, an abuser will continue on abusing and continue using funds because we didn't have access to them. Now, that's a broad statement and maybe some assumptions there, but it is a problem.
So that's about 250 out of the 2,500 that you had trouble getting financial records for?
Well, I wouldn't say that's the number we had trouble getting financial records for. Those are just...
That was the question.
Okay, thank you. I don't know that number, I guess, would be the short answer.
Other questions for this panel? All right, colleagues, just quickly, we'll have some other folks come back to testify after we hear the other bill. Just so you know what's in front of you, there is a letter from Belisa in the Legislative Council that I now can't put my hands on, but it was, thank you, it was distributed dated January 31st. I wanted to make sure this was part of the record. The Oregon Bankers Association is in support of this bill, but this was an important issue from them that I think should be clarified, and I hope that you'll take a look at it, and I want to make sure that it's part of the record. We also have at least five other written submissions of testimony that I want to bring to your attention and make sure those are in the record. And with that, I will temporarily close. I will recess the public hearing on House Bill, don't laugh at me, Frederick, 4084, and turn this over to my co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I will open up the work session on House Bill 47, or the public hearing on House Bill 47, and I know we have a couple of legislators here coming to testify. Thank you. And we have quite a few people here coming to testify, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And we're going to, because of the time limitation, we'll have to limit some of that. Okay, Representative, go ahead.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jules Bailey, State Representative, House District 42, Inner East Side, Portland. Thank you so much for making the time to hear this on an incredibly busy day, and we'll try to keep it brief and make sure that we have time to get all the testimony in. I also want to start off by thanking Representative Wand for his leadership and his partnership on this bill, and Senator Mona Sanderson, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. She is in her own committee chairing right now, but I believe has sent a letter to your committee as well. You may remember this issue. It was before your committee in the last session, and you may remember there were some questions about the fiscal and a few other issues with it. What I want to do very briefly is just remind you of the issue before us in the bill and walk through a little bit of how this bill differs from the one that you saw last session. I think we've come back with something that's much better than what you saw in the past, and hopefully addresses some of the concerns that were out there. First, I want to make sure that in the bill, while this is called the Healthy Teen Relationship Act, sometimes the shorthand for it has been the Teen Dating Violence Bill. I try not to use that shorthand because this really isn't about violence per se in the way that we often think about violence. When we think about sexual violence or physical violence, obviously we have laws on the books to deal with that. But this is really a much more holistic concept about how we help educate from and teach and coach from an early age teens to engage in the kinds of relationships that really make for long-lasting, healthy lives. This is about prevention, and it's about bending the arc of how people perceive what a healthy relationship is about. And it makes an enormous difference in the lives of the teens that have this kind of training, and it responds to what is unfortunately an epidemic here in Oregon. And although the unhealthy relationships are not always physical in nature, they can be about controlling behavior, domineering behavior, the consequences of those kinds of relationships can often be fatal. I, subsequent to the last session, attended the memorial service of a young woman in Portland who was shot by her boyfriend and had been in that relationship for a long time. Now, would the bill have made a difference in that particular case? I can't say. But what I can say is seeing the way that that broke a community, the way that that broke her family, led me to feel extremely passionately about coming back and making sure that we don't ever have that happen again in this state. And as I say, it not only does it make a difference in the lives of the victims and most often girls, it can also make a difference in the lives of boys as well. And as we look at graduation rates, as we look at drug abuse, as we look at incarceration rates, all of these things that the state pays for and pays a lot for are things that we can address most efficiently by getting involved at the front end, by an ounce of prevention putting off a pound of cure. And that's really what this bill is about. And you'll see a letter here from a school psychologist from Coos Bay that I believe somebody else will be testifying about later that really focuses on the fact that in addition to all of the benefits of this bill, that young men particularly benefit from this bill because often as teens they haven't developed as much and matured as much to understand the components of a healthy relationship. So where this bill is different from the last session, one, there was a confusing section in the last session that set aside for a longitudinal study an account that was to be funded through foundation support. That whole section was very difficult to score from the Legislative Fiscal Office, and it has been pulled. Second, and here I absolutely have to again thank Representative Wand and Senator Montes Anderson for getting us in touch with Gresham Barlow School District and the school districts that are implementing. We sat down with the school district, we went through and we made a series of technical changes that really made this a better bill and work better for the school districts and to make sure that it's manageable for them and that we're not creating cops here, that this is about really promoting healthy relationships as opposed to creating a new level of enforcement authority for schools that they can't take on. It's not about additional expectations on these schools. There are service providers that stand ready, have dollars that they can bring into the process. And then finally, we really made sure that through these amendments that we're bringing in parents into this discussion, that schools can bring in parents into this discussion, and that the curriculum is age-appropriate, is targeted appropriately, and that we're really focusing on those ages that will be in potentially in dating relationships or going into dating relationships. So I think all of those things make this a much stronger bill than last session. You have an amendment, a -1 in front of you, that clarifies the definition of teen dating violence. That was at the request of the school districts. It is a clarification of the federal definition, so I think hopefully everybody should be okay with that definition that's in front of you. And finally, this bill will have a fiscal. There, because of the survey that's in the bill, that the Healthy Teen Survey that the department already did. We'd like to add a module to see about the effects of this bill within that survey. You believe the fiscal that you have in front of you has listed it as the entire survey costs $250,000. That's not how much this bill would cost. That's, they already do the survey. My understanding from the department is that it would be somewhere in the order of magnitude of around $28,000 to add an additional module onto the bill. I think that's data is extremely appropriate, so we'd like to get this down to Ways and Means and let them chew on it and see if it's worth a prioritization. But from a policy perspective, I think it's sound, and we'd like to be able to get it onto Ways and Means. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Representative Wand, thank you for coming.
Thank you for the record, Matthew Wand, State Representative, House District 49. you know, Representative Bailey and I, in a certain respect, might be a little bit like the odd couple on a bill like this. But there's a very important reason why I feel passionately about this bill. And that's because as a legislator, maybe perhaps as a statesman, we have to govern and lead in the world that we find ourselves in, not in the world that we wish we found ourselves in. And one of the things that I have realized representing the Reynolds School District, which is where I attended high school, is that it's now a world where we have 70% of the students in my district on free or reduced lunch. It is a world where overwhelmingly students do not grow up in homes with positive environments, where they are learning how to have a healthy relationship by looking at two parents that are happy and that are comfortable financially. And that's a very different world from other areas in our state, particularly on the west side of the metro area, where maybe they're a little more affluent, and maybe this just doesn't seem like it's a very big deal. But in my area, it's huge. And I learned on the Judiciary Committee last session from some of our psychologists that when we deal with youngsters, we can change behavior for the remainder of their lives to a far greater degree than if we wait until they're into their 20s. And that's what this bill is trying to do. Reach the kids that need help. Teach them positive relationships while we still can. And before they make poor life choices or before they pattern behavior that maybe they see at home, and then thereby prevent them from having a worse life in general and give them the tools necessary to be better members of our own communities. And that's what we have here. So we have removed the types of things that you would stereotypically expect that I would be concerned with from my side of the aisle. You know, this is not an unfunded mandate. This is not a burdensome curriculum coming down from the state to rip away local control. None of those things are in this bill. We are giving the opportunity for our districts to do something positive and to help out youngsters that really need it at a time when they need it the most. So I urge you to please schedule this for a work session, move it down to Ways and Means, and let's see what we can do to get this bill passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I know, Representative Parrish, you have at least one question.
So you both just missed the other part of the hearing that we just had where Representative Greenlink was protesting that he's being considered a senior citizen. You've got an age range in here. 13 to 19, middle school, I got a sixth grader, it's 12, so they've already got kids who fall into that classification, and if Representative Gelser was here, she would tell you that there's kids in our K-12 system that go to 21, so the age determination in this, how'd you guys come up with that, or what's the logic behind that bracket?
Go ahead, please. Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Parrish, great question. That came out of work with our stakeholders who will be up here testifying as well in the school districts to identify what the most appropriate age range was to target this curriculum at. So I think that would probably be a question that would probably be better for some of the subsequent panels.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Colleagues, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people here to testify. There's some people who are in the building a lot. I'm wondering if you would mind coming back the next hearing. Would that be okay? And there's some people, at least there are a couple names I don't recognize. And so if you're on the list and I haven't called you and you don't live in the building like most of us do here, then please let me know. Is that okay? We will have another public hearing and a possible work session. So I know we have somebody from the Rayfield House, Megan Korax. Okay, great, Megan. Christine, you're here all the time. Roger Williams, do I know Roger Williams? Okay, great. And Lori, I know you're here all the time, so I'm going to wait on you. Is that okay? And John Wentworth.
Go ahead.
Hi.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the education coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. For those of you that don't know, Raphael House is a domestic violence agency. First and foremost, we have an emergency shelter. We have a number of other community-based resources that address the issue of domestic violence in our community. In my role at Raphael House as education coordinator, I raise awareness about domestic and sexual violence in the community. So primarily, a large part of my job is going out into high schools and middle schools and working with teens around healthy relationships, working in health classes, talking about what respect means, what that looks like, communication, equality, personal responsibility in relationships, and I built and developed a curriculum around that. So in my experience, I have seen a number of teens who experience dating violence in their lives. Statistically speaking, there was a study done by Sisters in Action and Power of girls in North and Northeast Portland. 75% of those have a friend who has been or is in an abusive relationship. Dating violence is something that drastically affects teens in their life, and you know, when you're experiencing something so traumatic so early on, that can really damage a person's psyche and damage the way a person experiences life from here on out. There's a quote from Teen Dating Violence, The Hidden Epidemic, from 2005. That goes, being abused in a relationship can shatter a teen's belief that she is a worthy, decent, and independent person who can cope with a life in a mature, self-assertive fashion. For the teen victim, the world becomes a frightening and confusing place where understanding how things are supposed to work is called into question. The victim's sense of her ability to protect herself and function autonomously is undermined. We know this, of course, talks about the victim being female, but we know this also happens to male survivors. There are also male survivors. But I can speak to this quote personally. One of the reasons that I'm involved in this work is because when I was in high school, one of my best friends was in an abusive relationship. You know, if you had asked me when I was a freshman in high school, when I was in middle school, if I would have ever known someone who experienced abuse, I would have said absolutely not. That doesn't happen to people like me. That doesn't happen to my friends. By the time I graduated high school, by the time I was in college, one of my best friends was almost killed by her partner. She was 16, 17 years old when this was happening. And, you know, I can go back and talk to her. She's still one of my best friends, thankfully. She has gotten out of that relationship. And is now, you know, a healthy adult. But I can speak to this quote that this has affected her entire life. This affects the way she has relationships. That relationship from when she was 15, 16, 17 years old still affects the way she sees the world today and the way she experiences relationships today. It's something that, you know, we talk often because of the work that I do about how education would have impacted her story, would have impacted her life. And, you know, she has regularly said to me that if there were education in her school, if, you know, there was education about healthy relationships, if she was in a school that addressed and identified dating violence as something that was a priority to them, that may have gotten her out of that relationship faster, that may have stopped her from getting involved in that relationship in the first place, that may have taught her that she deserved respect in a relationship, that she deserved, you know, equality in a relationship and what those things looked like. So I think it really speaks to the importance of this bill that, you know, we as a state address the issue of teen dating violence. We really, you know, look at that and say, you know, what kind of community are we building for the survivors, you know, in our community? What kind of community are we building for the teenagers that are in schools right now? And how can we, you know, build a safer community for everyone? And I think a large part of that is supporting this bill, is, you know, taking the first step in identifying and addressing that teen dating violence is a problem in Oregon, and how are we as a state going to really make this a priority and make it a priority for youth.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for coming up.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the record, my name is Roger Williams. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. As you may imagine, homeschooling parents deal with these issues with their children, take them very seriously. In Oregon, though, there's a wall between the state and the curriculum of private schools and homeschools, and I'm concerned. This is surely inadvertent, but in section 6, it says the director of the Oregon Health Authority shall create or include in any existing survey that is regularly conducted of students in ages in grades 8 and 12 in this state questions about teen dating violence. The rest of the bill is very clear that this applies to public schools. The Oregon Health Authority deals with a larger population than just the public schools. So we would appreciate it if you would substitute something to the effect, shall create a survey for the public schools or include any existing survey that is regularly conducted of public school students, so that it's clear that this survey is for public schools and not for home schools or private schools. Who would I talk with to get this type of amendment?
Representative Bailey and Representative Wand, the two gentlemen who spoke earlier.
Thank you.
Great, you bet. Thank you both. Any quick questions here? Thank you very much. And was there anyone who signed up who is not regularly in the building? Go, come on.
Actually, because of the elder abuse, he's
regularly
in the building. Yeah.
Chair Stamann, Gilliam, ladies and gentlemen, I have been before you before, and what you may not know, because I've spoken to you about elder abuse, is that I also wear another hat in my office, and that is the supervisor of the domestic violence unit. We combine those units.
John,
I'm sorry. Our office.
No,
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Please identify.
I'm sorry.
Identify for the record.
My name is John Wentworth. I'm with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. And regarding House Bill 4077, the Oregon District Attorney's Association supports this bill and supports it. I just want to offer some perspective in terms of why this bill is so important. Oftentimes, as a trial attorney, I have the opportunity to speak to citizens in the community during jury selection about domestic violence. And people have a pretty good understanding when we're talking about hitting someone or kicking someone or causing physical harm to another person what we're talking about. And if I ask a jury how many people have been victims of domestic violence or have been involved in a violent relationship or know someone close to them, I might get two or three hands of people in the jury raising their hands acknowledging that that's the case. If I ask people on the jury how many of them have been in a controlling relationship or know someone who's been in a controlling relationship where you've been concerned that perhaps violence is occurring, far more people raise their hands. As a prosecutor, I can tell you what I'm concerned about is that people have an acknowledgement. They know that maybe there's something going on behind closed doors. They don't know quite what it is. They know that there's behavior going on that they don't like, but they don't know how to address it. They don't know what that means, what it might mean for the future. We know that this kind of behavior progresses into violence or can. So something that starts out in a relationship, relationships don't begin as flowers and then a punch, and then it's an acknowledgement, well, that's the way it's going to be from here on out. It starts out with flowers and continues that way and then can move into controlling behavior and into violence. And we know that that happens all the time. So if you can arm people with education on what that might mean, what those signals might be, earlier on in their dating relationships, that benefits no one but the community as a whole and the individuals who are in those relationships themselves. I can also tell you that as a prosecutor, we send people to batterers intervention programs all the time. And those programs deal with people who are controllers themselves. And they use violence to control other people. And one of the benefits of seeing the people coming out on the other side of those programs is that they tell us, and in my opinion, it's in earnest, I didn't understand how controlling my behavior was. I didn't understand how my behavior was affecting the people I love. If you can give that information to someone who's in school, when they're beginning their dating relationships, rather than when they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s, or 50s, imagine how much better our community would be. And they don't have to go through a program like that. They don't have to be part of a criminal justice system. I think this will save us in the future in the criminal justice system. It will save us financially if we have this sort of program in our schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions here? Thank you very much for testifying on this. Thank you for all of you who testified and people who signed up to testify. This is a very important bill. We have every intention of having another hearing. As most of you here realize, we're in a very abbreviated session and we're trying to move things along. So we will be coming back to this And just on the record, we do have proposed amendments. Just one amendment, is that correct? Okay, and we have several letters, quite a few letters here that we've gotten in support of this bill. So with that, I think I'm going to...
Do you want to just start with the next
Yes,
panel?
I will. With that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 4077 and reopen the hearing on 4084. And Daryl Fuller, what is this? What's this about?
Maybe do Carol and John. It's like these appeals. So Carol and John. Daryl.
Oh, Daryl Fuller and John Wentworth. Thank you.
Okay.
Daryl.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller.
Back up again?
Sure.
Okay. Go ahead, Daryl.
Daryl Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, I'll be very brief. The Sheriff's Association Legislative Committee met. We looked through all the bills that you guys are working on during this session, and they strongly supported this bill and encourage you to pass it. Any tools that you can provide law enforcement to prevent abuse of anybody, including the elderly. We appreciate the tools in our toolbox and be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Done.
Once again, by way of introduction, I'm John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with Clackamas County DA's office. I'm here also on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association to offer our support of House Bill 4084. As you know, I was also part of the elder abuse work group that put this this effort together. I don't know if there's been a lot of questions so far, and I don't know if it would be helpful for me to answer any of those up front or.
John, can I interrupt for a moment?
Sure.
Can we switch the gavel without the next?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm sorry I was out of the room, and I do want you to answer questions. Will you hold fire for a moment?
Sure.
Daryl, you haven't testified, right?
No, I did.
Sorry.
I did want to mention that my favorite city is Hebo because I like the way it sounds.
Thank you, Daryl.
And my favorite color is blue, if that helps.
That's quite enough. So I'm sorry I missed it, apparently.
Okay.
So if you'll hold fire, if you gentlemen will step back for just a minute, I'm going to invite two other testifiers. And then, John, I would like to ask some questions.
Thank you.
I'd like to have Gail Meyer and Becky. And Becky, I'm sorry, is it Strauss?
Strauss.
Yes. Please come forward. And... Kevin's still in the room. Come on up, Kevin. And if you all would identify and please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, and members of the committee. I'm Gail Meyer. I'm the representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm pleased to be in front of the committee. Thank you. Our initial concerns as a committee did relate to sections 6, 8, and 10 as it relates to the method by which law enforcement or members of DHS could secure copies of medical records and financial records. And subsequently, we've had conversations with Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam, and so... But I do feel that it's important, perhaps in my testimony now, to address the bill as it is currently written. What I'd like to alert the committee is that this is a huge shift from the way in which we do things now. The way in which we do things now, by procedure and by statute, is for investigators to either serve a grand jury warrant, a grand jury subpoena, rather, that would compel the records into the grand jury, or they would go to the court and get a search warrant. What this essentially does is that it says for anyone 65 years of age or older in Oregon has less rights in their financial records and in their medical records does anyone in Oregon who is less than the age of 65. Because what these provisions read and say is that the line officer, the line investigator for DHS or their designee can truly just go up to the counter and say, represent, certify, I'm entertaining an investigation. Mr. Smith here is a suspected victim. Turn over the records forthwith right now. That's new. That's big. That's a huge change. I do note that in the federal realm as it relates to the financial records. I jumped over into federal law, and I thought, well, what do the feds do with respect to security records? The truth of it is, and I will acknowledge to this committee, the level of privacy and security and personal ownership that one can expect in their financial records or their medical records is truly a matter of state law, and you're entitled to make those policy determinations. Congress, with respect to federal law, has said that with respect to federal law, there is a privacy interest in federal records, and if an FBI agent wants to go get these federal records, they have to go get a summons or a court order or a grand jury subpoena or a search warrant, but there is some oversight and some procedural protections there. The one exception are the national security letters, and those are the letters that are done for counterintelligence investigations where they're suspecting international terrorism or foreign spying. But even then, in the event of international terrorism, it's not the line officer who has the authority to just roll up to the window and say, give me the records. They have to go up through the chain of command and get certification. But that is a very rare exception. That's for international terrorism suspects. And so, with respect to issues of financial fraud or abuse, an FBI agent would have to go get a search warrant. So this committee gets to decide what's the level of security that we would expect of a DHS worker or a law enforcement officer in this state. We would suggest that the way things currently are works well. It gives people protections. Grand jury subpoenas are something that can be done. They compel them into the grand jury. Or you get a search warrant with oversight by a judge. I haven't heard yet any testimony that that doesn't make things that shouldn't be followed, continue to be followed here. I will acknowledge a search warrant is inconvenient for law enforcement, but it's also a cornerstone of our freedoms. It's what keeps the government at bay. There was a representation that really this was simply closing a loop, that a financial agency could give records to law enforcement or to DHS if they suspected abuse, and so they were just closing the loop backwards. But that is what the warrant requirement is all about. Someone can go up to law enforcement and say, here's what's in my backpack. It's different for law enforcement to go to the individual and say, let me see what's in your backpack. So the reason you have the warrant requirement is when it's the government that's doing the demanding and the requesting. So that's with respect to Section 6, 8, and 10. That could be easily fixed, by the way, by removing Sections 6, 8, and 10. Then you would have existing procedures, which is the grand jury subpoena or a search warrant. With respect to Section 2, which extends the statute of limitations for the designated crimes on page 3, this is where it intersects with the question posed by Representative Greenleck. What about the breadth to which the statute applies? This applies to everyone over the age of 65, vulnerable or no. So what the statute of limitations provision in Section 2 would do, it extends the statute of limitations for 6 years regardless of whether you have a vulnerable elder or not. And so there's no need here that the elder be demented, not be able to relate or recall, but simply by purview of age, you're extending the limitation period. In the world of criminal defense lawyers, a statute of limitation period is really essential. It is the cornerstone upon which we can have a fair trial or not. There are so many rights that attach, that are have a foundational underpinning into how promptly charges are brought. The right to a speedy trial, the right to find witnesses, the right to compel evidence into the courtroom. A paper trail alone might say that something occurred, but it doesn't tell you the circumstances under which it did occur. There might have been an aide or a helper or a niece who drove someone to the bank, all of whom can give context and meaning to what was said, what was done, how that elder was acting. And if you can't find those individuals or if they cannot recall, then you cannot recreate the events. So the breadth of the statute in applying to everyone over the age of 65 links in with our concerns about extending the statute of limitation period, because there's no basis of showing that it's necessary if you don't confine the breadth of the bill to those who are vulnerable. And lastly, with respect to elevating the assault forward to a felony status, and I'm looking at Section 1, I have a few comments about that. We do get hypersensitive about making misdemeanors felonies, but let me just make these comments to the committee. I think this is a lot of buck, but for very little bang. And what I mean by that is, it's the minute you make something a felony, you are then jumping into the sentencing guidelines, sentencing guideline grid. And the presumptive sentence for an assault 3, if you don't have a prior criminal record, is 90 days in local jail. You would not go to prison for this. It would be 90 days in local jail. Now, that could be, you could have aggravating circumstances, but generally the presumption is you would be doing 90 days in local jail. If you actually were convicted of a misdemeanor, that sentencing judge would have the full range of a one-year sentence to play with. That judge could sentence them to 90 days if they violated them, make them serve 30 more days, whatever. But a judge in a misdemeanor would have the full range of a year's sentence to work with in setting up a sentence. Whereas if the minute you're under the guidelines, you're limited to the presumptive range of the guidelines, which, quite frankly, is much less. So in our world, sometimes we like having our clients exposed to the felony sentence rather than the misdemeanor sentence. Secondly, I will just simply say I think you'd have a fiscal impact from that, but I don't know that you would have realistically much gain. Secondly, it's a little redundant because the criminal mistreatment in the first degree is a C felony, and it does pick up physical injury for someone who has temporary care of an elder. And so I think that you really don't need to elevate your assault for. You've already got another charge that will get you there. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Strauss.
Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here representing the ACLU of Oregon. I wanted to just take a second first and apologize for not participating in the work group. I haven't been on very long, and our organization was not aware that the work group was going on. So I do appreciate all the good work that they put in and hope that we can be involved in the conversations going forward, because we do have some issues to raise. I do appreciate the earlier comments of Representative Greenlich and Representative Widener regarding these privacy protections. These are our fundamental concerns about the bill as drafted, and I'm encouraged by the testimony of Representative Hoyle that this is not necessarily the intent, and I hope we can work with you as we...
Let me interrupt you just for a second. I appreciate those comments and our conversation before the committee meeting. For you and for Gail, just for my clarification, did we afford you the dash ones? So your comments are in the context of the dash ones.
I have, Representative Gilliam, I've just seen the dash ones sitting here in the audience.
It's new to you, but you were aware in your testimony. That's all. I just was a clarification. Please continue.
And I think having read... looks like it puts a few further restrictions on the financial piece. And I did want to take a second to address some of the issues around medical privacy. Ms. Meyer was able to address the issues around financial privacy. And as sitting here and listening to the testimony, I pulled up the HIPAA statute, which is a federal privacy law relating to disclosure of medical records. It is true, from what I can read, I'm no HIPAA expert, and health privacy is very complicated for me. But it appears that there are exceptions to the disclosure prohibitions for healthcare providers within the areas of abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, and some other areas. But just reading here, and I can provide the site, it's 45 CFR 164.512. There are additional sidebars. So if the state governments do provide a state statute allowing for disclosure in the instance of an adult abuse investigation, it does need to include things like the healthcare provider demonstrating that disclosure is actually necessary, as opposed to just putting it on the requester for that information. And then it does appear that there's a notification requirement to the patient that those records have been disclosed. And as I'm seeing the bill now, it's that those protections and sidebars are not in there. The other issue that I would want to flag and hope we can discuss further is what is available in terms of restrictions and protections once that information is obtained by the investigators, so DHS and law enforcement. I'm unclear about how they can use that information, who they can share it with, what they are allowed to review in that record, all those types of things on the back end, what protections might be there. So aside from the privacy issues, I want to echo the comments of Ms. Meyer related to the escalation of the crime of abuse. Again, we are cautious about creating new crimes. We don't really expect the enhanced penalty to serve as a deterrent, but instead is just acting as risking to enhance the penalty for something where there is already a criminal consequence for assault four. The other thing I just wanted to note, which I haven't heard much discussion of so far in the hearing, so wanted to raise the issue, is the changes to the never-never list, quote-unquote never-never list of crimes that are convictions that are a permanent bar to employment. My understanding is that exists now in current statute, and part of what this bill is doing is taking some and making it not a permanent bar, but a five-year bar. What I would suggest in the alternative, and I should add, it is adding five crimes to the permanent bar list. What I would suggest is when an agency is making a determination that someone is not eligible for an employment in a particular area, we would like to see the fitness determination method used for all of those crimes, and that system is in place for several of the convictions, just not the ones that are set out in statute now and being amended a bit by this bill. So we'd like to take a look at those and make an alternative suggestion. I think that's it for now. I would also say that we are in support of Representative Hoyle's suggestion that we take a look at this in the Judiciary Committee as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Before we shift gears, any questions for these two testimony testifiers? Seeing none.
Chair, is that a parallel bill in the Judiciary Committee? Is it the same bill?
It is close to identical. That's all I can tell you. And
which route is it going? Is it intended to be?
This route. But what was I'll respond to that to say this, that we wanted, because of the shortness of the session, compression, legislation by compression, as I like to say, we wanted to be sure, as you've heard today, that the technical, judicial, and otherwise technical criminal aspects were vetted by that committee so that we wouldn't be here forever or fail to meet the time requirements that we're under.
Mr. Chair, since we're on the other side of the fence now, you heard my concerns in Representative Greenlick's and the abuse that Representative Gilliam puts on Mr. Greenlick. My question is, when this happens, they just go look, pull his records and say, yes, Representative Gilliam's done something here, and it goes to a mandatory sentencing. That kind of throws out the plea bargaining and everything, because if he's convicted, it's that. And there's no changing it. There's no negotiating for anything. Is this correct? So it's automatically probably going to go to a jury trial at that point, or can you kind of play out a scenario of where someone is caught for doing this, or they're a suspect?
Sure. Chair Gilliam and Representative Widener, if I understand your question right, once the records are secured, it's hard to predict what would happen. It's hard to predict what charges would be filed. One thing I've wondered, if you got financial records and you thought, well, I don't think they're a victim of financial fraud, but maybe they've been committing Medicaid fraud. I don't know. I mean, once they've gotten the records, they've got the records. And then what the charges are would depend upon really what they show, what the allegation or concern might be, and then they would present it to a grand jury. Once those charges are issued by the grand jury, then there would be presumptively an arrest, and then there would be a lawyer appointed, and then there would be reciprocal discovery. Both sides would share their reciprocal evidence, and then they would be negotiating. These are not mandatory minimum sentences. if we're talking about assault three or identity, well, identity theft could possibly be a measure 57, but these would not be measure 11s. Well, unless it's a measure 11, and then probably they wouldn't be getting financial records. So, but what would generally show from financial records would not be a mandatory minimum crime. Your assaults, it could be if it were an assault one or an assault two.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair, real quickly? Would you be more comfortable with it if there was some sort of system in place where there had to be not only the allegation, but someone in the family that's contacted that isn't involved with it, or next of kin, kind of a progression level that they went to find out, to help them expedite if there's some sort of abuse? Because I know where they're coming from, and I support where they're coming from, and want to make sure we're protecting seniors. But I also don't, I mean, as much as I'd like to know how much money that Representative Greenlick has in his account, I would also want to protect him from me finding out, or letting the state find out, or the local city or government find out. But if for some reason he's being abused, I want it to be able to get caught quickly before his account's drained. So have you thought about a process of a way this could happen
co-chairs,
in a protective manner?
Thank you. Co-chairs, Representative Wendler, I can tell you that our first response was to react to the language in the bill. And what the language says scares us very much. It basically allows a line officer to just make a demand and get records. There are, in looking at the federal provisions, there are ways to get court orders. You can get a telephone subpoena. Then we've got a statutory provision for a telephone search warrant, telephone search warrant. There are expedited procedures that we have by statute. This is expeditious as written, but I would...
That's just a free-for-all for somebody.
Thank you. Your words.
All right. Thank you, and we're going to move on and to Kevin Christensen from the Bankers Association. Kevin?
Thanks. Co-chairs Gilliam and Tomei, Kevin, and members of the committee, Kevin Christensen, Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Bankers Association. I will be very brief. First of all, our organization has been very active in elder abuse for some time now. We have a manual for our frontline staff in particular that is issued and has gotten actually international notoriety amongst the banking community for preventing elder abuse. We're very pleased with that. We're in the midst of revising it and look forward to sharing it with this committee going forward. We are in support of the bill. I want to thank Representative Gilliam and Representative Hoyle for their indulgence, particularly with respect to the letter opinion from Legislative Council clarifying a reimbursement issue as it set forth in the letter. That is what we believe the statute to say, so we do appreciate that. We are supportive. I'd also like to just say that we appreciate Representative Gilliam's legislative assistant, Amanda Dalton, who has been truly a workhorse in terms of holding my hand through this process and getting it through it as far as getting the amendment. So I'm happy to answer questions if there are any. The only thing I would add to it, as we were sitting back discussing some of these issues, financial institutions do have the ability to disclose financial records. It's provided in 192.586 subsection 2. There is discretion for the financial institution, if there's a suspect, there's a belief that elder abuse has occurred, to turn records over to law enforcement authorities, the state agency. So I would just add that. With that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. And colleagues, my first and foremost concern when I was first introduced to this issue by Representative Tomei was the physical abuse. But then once you start looking at elder abuse, you quickly go to financial abuse, which is not, in my opinion, more important, but is extremely serious. So I am very grateful that the Oregon Bankers Association has participated all the way along with the folks at the Credit Union Association. Unfortunately, our stalwart there is now become quite ill, and so we're very concerned about her. We're sorry she couldn't be here today. But to have the financial institutions cooperating with us, because you're the front line of where a lot of this actual fraud starts, I appreciate it very much. If there are any quick questions for this testifier, I'd be happy to entertain them. Otherwise, we thank you for your testimony. And as we move on and close, I again want to ask John if he'll come back up. John Wentworth, Assistant DA at Clackamas County, another very valuable member of our work group, both work groups.
the one that I've told you about over and over, which is the adult protection team that the director started, that morphed, if I can use that word, or at least linked to this workforce. And John's been there every step of the way. Fred, if you'll stand by, too. John, you can say a few words. I know you're ready to take questions. If you'll just tee us up one more time, and then we'll have questions of this very expert witness.
I will. Just by way of, I am the, for today, the representative for the Oregon District Attorneys Association, offering our support in favor of this House bill. Obviously, you know, we've mentioned this before, the purpose behind the bill is to provide as much protection to elders in Oregon as we can, to shore up and better the work that we've been doing already, to in my view, bring us closer to protecting people who need protection. And as hard or difficult or perhaps unfair to use the word vulnerable adult, even as I've passed into middle age, I start to realize that I'm getting closer to that age myself, and yet there are things that I notice even physically in middle age that are different than they were when I was even younger. And as a matter of practicality, when we're talking about physical abuse, and again to wear two hats now with domestic violence and elder abuse, what I've come to learn is that on those cases that I have seen in the past involving elders, even in a domestic violence context, and this goes to Representative Greenlick's question about a 64-year-old and a 65-year-old, and whether or not that should actually constitute some sort of elder abuse. In my view, I have done a disservice, perhaps, to generally women, elder women, and not viewing those cases as elder cases. The reason being is that the fact of the matter is, the older we get, the slower we heal, the injuries that we receive become more significant. And when I see abuse of elders, the abuse tends to be worse than the abuse I would see on a younger person. That is a fact. It's not a fact necessarily of the force that was used against the person. It's the impact it has on the victim who receives it.
Mr. Chair, can I comment on that?
Yes.
That's physiologic nonsense. I mean, there is not a physiologic difference between a 64-year-old and a 66-year-old except a tiny increment. Physiologically, we age in a progression. And the notion that you would treat a fight between a 64-year-old and a 66-year-old as elder abuse to the point of charging them with a C felony, there's no basis for that in reality whatsoever.
And it solely comes down to drawing a line at some point. The difference in
doesn't come down to drawing an age line at all. It comes down to determining what vulnerable means.
Absolutely. And Representative Greenlick, the difference between a 10-year-old who gets abused and a 9-year-old is also insignificant. The damage is just as bad. The sexual abuse that occurs to a 14-year-old versus a 13-year-old is just as bad. And yet we treat those differently in the law. It's a fact of drawing a line at some distinction. And we do it all the time.
That's why the prison budget has quadrupled in the last 10 years.
Because there are people who do bad things.
Representative Greenlick, if we let him finish, I'd be happy to have you follow.
No.
Go right.
With regard to some of the concerns that I've heard today, specifically regarding criminal mistreatment versus assault 3, the reason we address this as an assault 3 issue and not just within criminal mistreatment is that we also see abuse by people against elders who are not in a caretaking capacity. We see sons and daughters who assault their elder parents, and they're not caring for them. And yet we treat that as a misdemeanor. But if they happen to get hired the day before in some caretaking capacity, magically it becomes a felony. The problem is the abuse is just as bad. The effects are just as grievous to the victim. And that's an anomaly in the law. And that's one of the reasons we're treating this as an assault, enhancing it to an assault felony rather than having it as a misdemeanor. It can't be dealt with in the criminal mistreatment realm, with all due deference to my legal colleague. The statute of limitations issues. it was discussed that this is one of the cornerstones. It is. Currently, the law reads that if there is a breach of fiduciary responsibility or fraud in the criminal statute or in the facts of the case that we're dealing with, the statute's actually kind of complicated in terms of what you can do and what the statute of limitations is. It's 3 years or one extra year beyond when you discover it, but no longer than 6 years. We've capped it at 6 years in total, in part because sometimes we have cases that don't involve fraud at all. It's just simply theft. So if I don't have a case that involves some fraud, I can work it in there somehow. My statute of limitations is capped at 3 years, despite the fact that this person's been stealing from the elder for a number of years, and it may take a great deal of effort to uncover the method that was used. It may not be fraud. It may not be fraudulent, but it's still theft. And we are having a great deal of difficulty getting those cases within the statute of limitations. It's almost impossible, because by the time we do get a search warrant, a subpoena, get the financial records, analyze those records to determine what they mean, if anything, get the case to prosecution. Sometimes we are literally bumping up on the statute of limitations by the time I get the case, just for review. And that assumes that I don't have any further investigation that needs to be done to determine whether or not there's a crime that's been committed. Extending the statute of limitations no further than what the statute at its limit right now would allow us greater time to conduct those investigations in a thorough and complete manner. One of the concerns with regard to getting the financial records is, well, what kind of standard is going to be used for that? Why can't we just get a telephonic warrant? With all due respect to my colleague, telephonic warrants are required for or allowed for emergent moments. Moments when you're at the roadside and you have someone who's been drinking and driving and you need a search warrant in that moment and you don't have time to get some written document. They're not appropriate for a case like this. So that's not an option. All this provision would do is allow law enforcement to go to the banking institution, get the same information the banking institution can provide to law enforcement if it's the financial institution that initiates it. So if the bank says, hey, we think there's something, we have reasonable suspicion to believe something bad is happening, they can go to law enforcement. But if law enforcement or APS goes to the bank, there's a much greater, longer process that goes into place. And I understand the protections. We want protections, but it's an irony in the law that they can tell us, but we can't ask them. This would, as Mr. Steele said, close that loop. I don't know if there are other issues that anyone wanted me to address, if I can.
Any other comments or questions before we close this hearing? Representative Wagner, quickly.
What would be so wrong with getting a warrant for the financial records? I mean, because it's, even if we allowed you to do a telephonic warrant, there needs to be something there, going to a next of kin, because just the way I read this now, this is giving whatever police department access to those records to just go get them. And I am, as much as I support this bill and am ready to vote for it, as long as that language stays the same, I can't vote this out of this committee. I would be doing an injustice to every person over the age of 65. I mean, my stepdad, who just busted his hip at 72, would take the walker that he has for the next month and beat me to kingdom with it, and I have no recourse for the abuse he would put on me.
Well, keep in mind that it's not a provision without any standard. There's a reasonable suspicion standard that has to be met before the law enforcement officer can go to the bank and say, we'd like to see the records. It also doesn't presume that there's been any crime that's been committed. It's an investigative tool. A search warrant is an officer saying, it is more likely than not a crime is being committed, and I would like those records. Mm-hmm. This is something shy of that, something short of that, that says, it looks like this could be happening, we'd like to see. It's the same standard that the banks can apply. It appears to us that there is fraud or theft going on. We'd like you to take a look at it. So it just goes the other direction.
Follow up?
No. We're going to close this hearing. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your input. Thank you, John, for being here. Colleagues,
I appreciate your tough and serious questions about this bill. I want to first of all make sure you understand that the dreaded "we don't have the paperwork" has struck. This bill will not be moved today. We'll have to wait till next week. If you continue to have concerns, I would be happy to field those. I obviously would share them with my co-chair and talk about these things offline or put you in touch with resources that may be helpful. But I think what I want to say to the committee, Madam Chair, before we close is this. I would just simply, I cannot possibly summarize everything that's been said today, everything that's been said in our work group, everything that we've worked on in the protective team, but I can tell you that one quote sort of stands out, and I believe Representative Hoyle, who helped me co-chair this, would bear this out as a seminal moment. It's at the very beginning, because in addition to Representative Hoyle, Senator Prezansky and Senator Winters were in the room, and Senator Winters simply appealed to us to bring us close to or up to the standard that this state has for child abuse. Because in my view, we have let elders out of that, and they need to come up to that statute. We are not doing, as complex as you've seen today, we are not doing everything in this bill, and we didn't plan to. Much more needs to be done. Much more needs to be done in the fundamental area of the definition of elder abuse. But I'm telling you as strongly as I can that this is a positive step forward. I appreciate all, I know you're all busy and we have lots of bills. I especially want to say again publicly that I appreciate my co-chair's indulgence because I've had this group in, exposed to you all, 4 times. And we'll have one more hearing on this. And thank you all for your indulgence. And we shall continue next week. If you don't have any other comments, Madam Chair, I'm going to, before I close the hearing today, I'm going to carry over the possible work session on House Bill 4084 and the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 4077 to the agenda, our next meeting, Monday, February 6, 2012. The meeting is adjourned.